Okay, we're just talking about the physical expansion of the School of Education in the 1960s. Yeah.
The Lynn had been working hard to get additional research money, and of course this was a period during which the school was expanding in terms of enrollments, and especially graduate enrollments, some related to research money and some just related to the general graduate expansion of the late 50s and the early 60s. And so when the lab school was being closed, which was basically Lynn's interest in closing it, it no longer served a purpose. The old notion of having a demonstration school, which would show people how things ought to be done, was so badly unmet by the lab school here, both in terms of its terrible physical facilities, and probably principally that, and also probably the fact that it wasn't doing anything that unusual. So I think that Lynn decided that that would be some, and it no longer adequately handled the student teaching anyway, so he decided to eliminate it.
Now in the mid-50s, though, it came up at least once I know of a proposal to expand Wisconsin High School, to renovate it, to build a new facility, which in part at least would have answered some of those questions.
Yeah.
Why wasn't that done? Do you know?
No, I do not know why that was not done. I suspect it wasn't done because they couldn't generate enough interest and support for it fiscally to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't happen to know whether Lynn was really strongly supportive of that move or not. Was that that could have happened toward the end of Fox's administration? Do you recall?
It happened in 1955.
It's about the time
so
of the transition.
About the time of the transition.
Well, it probably would have developed as a proposal under Fouts. And when Lynn came in, my guess would be that he was never basically very supportive. That he felt that we'd be much better off to work with a large variety of public schools. And furthermore, Lynn was trying to move away from the notion of student teaching per se, because I think Lynn believed strongly that you had to have either blocks or something like the internship, which developed later.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that when he then finally decided to close it, the basic opposition he had from closing it really probably came from two sources, and that's a lot of faculty families in Madison or other Madison families from Shorewood, for example, principally because Shorewood did not have a high school, which wanted to continue the use of that high school, as well as some faculty members who were functioning in the school, essentially the methods faculty. So when he made the decision to close it, then I remember he practically turned blue when the university took it away from him as a physical facility, because he felt that we needed that facility badly in terms of the physical needs, space needs of the
right.
school. And without I would say adequate consultation, they just decided they were going to assign that to somebody else. And so at that point, Lynn really blew his stack. And we either then this may have happened before, but my recollection is it would have been about that time he developed the long range planning committee for the space needs of the school, which if I recall, I chaired. I'm not sure,
mm-hmm.
but I think I did during that period. And that developed the plans which in effect have been implemented, and the last one of that plan really is the Southeast Dorm Recreation Facility, which has now been approved for planning by the legislature,
mm-hmm.
just within the last few months by the Building Commission. So that developed. Now, at the time that happened, it was clear then that Lynn decided that school had to expand physically. And he pressed so hard, I think, using the loss of Wisconsin High School as his principal motivating factor, both for him and for the impact on the president, that within a year, certainly, we had facilities and rented from the Octopus Car Wash, right next door to the Octopus Car Wash, that old yellow building that sits
oh,
out
uh-huh.
there,
right.
which has been recent years. I don't know what it is now, but then following us, it became the language study of Professor Cassidy's, up to the second block of State Street, where the placement office was located. So, and also Phil Lambert's shop, which was the, what the hell did they call that? They called it, what did they call that research unit that Phil Lambert ran, which is the thing that got the money that came out of Wisconsin High School?
The Instructional Research
Lab. The Instructional Research Lab, right. Yeah, I'd forgotten what it was called. But Lynn set that up as a place to house the money and to have this money available as a pot for stimulating other research.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he used it for several years, and Phil Lambert ran that shop and so on. But I think that was, the school just burst in terms of space, and we went, I don't know, if you looked at the figures, it would be worth looking at to see what the total space occupied by the School of Education was. In fact, I'm sure the documentation is there in the school. I've forgotten what it is. But in terms of the space we occupied and what the space we occupied, say, by 1965. And you might want to look at that, because that was the beginning of the physical growth. We had been really confined to the old education building, a bunch of temporary facilities. I remember Harvey, the glass blower, Harvey, is his name?
Littleton.
Harvey Littleton had a special facility, which is now a launderette, or what do you call those things?
A laundromat?
Laundromat on South Randall Street.
Uh-huh.
It was a metal building.
Wow,
that's where he had his lab. And we just, moved all over to burst out of that building, get out of it. So from that point on, then it was much easier to justify other kinds of expenditures. Although one of the interesting things which may or may not turn up in terms of physical facilities expansion was that at the time that Angus Rothwell was the head of the Coordinating Council on Higher Education, the university brought in its annual budget request, or its annual capital request to the Coordinating Council. And down, like number 35 on the list, was a replacement for the teacher for the education building.
Uh-huh.
And Rothwell said, as he was going out of the council within a few months, he said, "You mean that still is now listed as number 35 as a university priority?" He said, "When it's a disgrace to the state of Wisconsin." And they moved that up to, I don't know, number 3 or 4 or something in the university's request. And I remember everyone was scurrying around trying to get a program described for this as an emergency. Fortunately, we had done a lot of the planning work in this planning committee. And so they got that program together, and that was one of the last buildings, the present teacher education building on the corner of Dayton and Mills, was one of the last classroom buildings that the university built, because following that period, the classroom buildings became very hard to get. And so I've always argued that that building, of all others, should be named Angus Rothwell Hall, because he personally got it for the university. If he had not done that, we never would have gotten down to number 35 on that list, and we never would have gotten that building.
I presume that while you were shuttling the School of Education off back and forth all around almost the diaspora, you were planning a lot of these other buildings, for instance, Unitude Gym was being planned, that sort of thing. Can you tell me a little bit about what went into that? You know, who were the people who were active in pushing for the different units? That is, I presume that not just Mr. Stiles, but other people had certain things in mind for the new buildings.
There were two or three. Lynn was subject to substantial criticism for having one of the early buildings that he supported was a physical education building. He was criticized both inside the school by the non-Phi Ed people as well as in the university community generally, but Lim believed in that, and he believed that that was a responsibility of the school to the whole university, and that since that was the case, then it was a service requirement which we had and which we needed to provide for, and so he argued strongly for that building. So that was the first of the buildings, and I think it was because of Lim's belief that we had a service responsibility to all students and that the facilities here were so totally inadequate. Lim was not himself physically, well, he was active, but he didn't do anything that I know of, like play tennis or jog or anything else. Nobody was jogging in those days anyway. But so I think that in looking over the needs of the school, the way he perceived those needs, they came up in two or three major areas. One was physical education facilities, and both Unit 1 and Unit 2 of the gyms, plus the Southeast Campus recreation facility, which he felt those came in there. The other thing which he pushed hard for and which we got was the support for what he called research, and that's what's called educational sciences, which is kind of a cruddy name, but that's what the building is called, and it was like that really is because of Lynn's interest in trying to communicate the research, the essential research orientation of the school. And it was through his activity and his pressing for federal research funds and the support for federal research funds, plus building a good case here, that really got that building, which as you probably know or recall, was essentially paid for substantially by the federal government. I think it's the only building that the federal government built for any school of education in the United States. They stopped making provisions for that shortly after this one was built. So I think then the only other need he did see a need for the replacement of the teacher education, the old education building, into what would be a good curriculum and instruction teaching facility, because Lynn was basically a teacher, and his field had been English education. He was a methods teacher, and you know, he wrote in that field, and he was of that, that was his principal interest. So he had a strong interest in improving the teaching of the school, and the committee, the planning committee, consisted of representation from all the areas, and we simply looked at all the needs, and it wasn't a complicated problem because the school had no facilities. If you look at the old education building, it's a crappy building. It still is a crappy building. And even with remodeling, it's the last of the buildings on the campus, you know, which is wood construction. The wing, which is the northwest wing of that, is an addition, and that has steel, reinforced concrete. But the rest of that building is a wood frame building. And it really wasn't capable of being utilized. You couldn't develop any kind of laboratories in that building of the kind that Lynn thought were essential for teaching and for research. Demonstration teaching and for research, and it really required new facilities to do that. So I'd say that we simply started on the assumption we didn't have anything, and we just designed the facilities based on projections that as to where the school was going to go in terms of enrollments in the 60s and the 70s, and the developing research needs of the school.
How was the art department in this transfer to humanities? Did you have to negotiate for that, for the space in that building?
I don't think really. I think that, Harrington was looking. Yeah, Harrington was looking for a building that for history, because that's a huge department and was his field. And I think that Harrington probably put together the humanities thrust of that building to include history in with the humanities, because what we really got, of course, if you look down that area, the area that it occupied, that the space it occupies in space, was occupied largely by music facilities that were across the street there, and music had terribly inadequate facilities. They had old three or four old houses in that area, plus music hall, which was inadequate, and art was badly housed. It didn't have, as I said, Harvey Littleton was down in a metal building on South Mills, and we had that Quonset hut, which, is that thing still standing there? Yeah, is it there or isn't it there? In the education lot. It they're still
there. Yes, it's a storage.
Yeah, it's a storage area, but it's still there. So I think that Harrington really put that together as a humanities building. And not only, I'm not trying to say he only wanted a building for history, I think Harrington was interested in the humanities as an historian. And so I don't think you, but Lynn could tell you that. I don't recall. My assumption would be that it was a natural development of the interested parties to develop a good case for a new facility, and that out of developing a case for music and art, which are in two different schools, of course, they included history, which had a need in terms of Bascom's use.
Now, Mr. Rothfeld interceded for you to a certain extent for the educational sciences.
No, with teacher education.
Or teacher education, I'm sorry. But with Unit 2 Gym, you apparently could have used an intercessor and lacked one.
That problem was exaggerated, but I shared that sense of, what's the word I want, rage. That Lynn did, because what happened on that building is that building went ahead since there was totally inadequate recreation recreation facilities on the campus. That wasn't hard to defend in those days. But what happened then was that as that building was being planned in the planning stage by the architects, and I've forgotten what the budget of it was, this building was also being planned. And at that point, you know, the way planning goes, this has been going on for anywhere from 2 to 4 years. And at that point, the UW became a system. And the Milwaukee campus had been attached in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And then Harrington started the Green Bay and Parkside campuses and separated Extension and the Center system from Madison. And so we now had a 5 or 6 unit system. And Harrington was building the system administration for that unit. And we wanted places to house them, because if we're going to have a Madison campus chancellor, then we had to have some kind of expanded facilities for a system. So he wanted to add 3 floors to this building, and he didn't have any money to do it, so he simply proposed borrowing from the gym about $1,750,000, if I recall, and attaching it to this building. Now, there wasn't really any problem with that, because it did not delay the gym at all. The problem occurred in that Lynn was gone overseas or someplace, and I picked up the paper one morning, and here is an announcement in the paper that says that the president is proposing that they take $1,750,000 from the money allocated for the gym to put 3 floors on this building, whatever it was. And, you know, nobody had told me, nobody had told Lynn, nobody had said a thing about it. So Lynn came back within a day or two, and he just turned blue again on the same principle. And we both went up to see Harrington. And I remember at the time, I said to Harrington, I said, I think that's an incredible piece of administrative operation. And I said, I think it's, you know, unbelievable. I don't understand why anybody would do that without informing the interested parties, so that you have to pick up the paper to read it.
Mm.
Now, it didn't, as I said, it really wasn't, that was the only fault. As Lynn said, if he had asked me, I'd have said fine.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't even consult. He didn't even have the courtesy to consult on an allocation of a building which was his responsibility. So it didn't delay that building at all, because the building wasn't yet ready, and so they turned around in the next appropriation, got it back, and got it in for that building, and that building went right along as planned. It did not get delayed or deferred.
There is one aspect to that building, though. I think, as originally proposed, there should be 3 units. And there was supposed to be a unit for women's physical education as well.
No, that one was always planned for the Southeast. That Unit 3 is the one which is, that's the women's unit and the Southeast dorm recreational unit. That's the one now going up. That was never planned for this, and the $1,750,000 which was taken off was put back. So there wasn't any loss of funds on that. And Unit 3 was, Unit 1 is the natatorium, Unit 2 was the gym part out here. Unit 3 was a Southeast gym and women's facility, say, to replace Lathrop.
Didn't the women get a little upset, though, with the...
Well, no, either the delay?
Yes.
I don't think so, because remember the women had a better facility than the men had by far in Lathrop Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And while it wasn't adequate, it was better than Unit 2. It was better than the old Red Gym,
mm-hmm.
any day of the week. So I think that could be they would have liked to have been number one, but you got to remember too that in 1960 men outnumbered women substantially on the campus. So in terms of use needs, there were a hell of a lot more men than women. That's mm-hmm. no longer true today.
Mm-hmm.
It's reversed. So it's about even now, 50-50. So I'm not justifying it. To my knowledge, I don't recall any complaint on it. That in the way in which those were staged and phased, it was essentially a political argument as to what you thought you could get. And so that we thought we could get the Unit 2 of the men's gym, and then the women actually shared that. One of the other things Lynn did was to combine the men's and women's physical education department
mm-hmm.
into a single department, so because he felt that it would strengthen both units and that it would become a stronger research unit.
But he might have begun that. That wasn't completed, though, until like 1970, was it?
No, it was completed. I thought it was completed in the middle 60s as a single research unit. They had separate undergraduate departments, but they had a single combined graduate department.
Okay.
They may still, I don't know if they have undergraduate departments separate now. But see, the undergraduate department was essentially a service department. What he combined was the graduate
mm-hmm.
department and made a single graduate department. I'm pretty sure that was done in the early 60s.
Was that something that he wanted to do independently, or was it something that the faculty came to him and said, we'd like to merge?
This is one that Lynn wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And I think he persuaded them that it would be to their mutual benefit to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were getting to the point where they had overlapping in courses. The women were beginning to pursue. There was no longer a separation in terms of goals.
Mm-hmm.
Men and women were pursuing the same ends, and there isn't any difference. There isn't any essential difference in men's and women's physiology except that related to sex.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the musculature and other things theoretically structures are the same. So that I think his argument was that the way they were developing their research thrusts, they really had to be a separate department, or they'd be, and their instructional thrust at the graduate level, or they'd be overlapping. Each of them would begin to offer testing and this sort of thing, physical testing, other kinds of tests and measurements related to physical activity, and there's no reason for that to be separate.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't recall that there was some resistance to it. The women particularly resented it because they felt that they would not, they would be. Well, it's the same argument you get with intercollegiate athletics. If you merge them, who's going to be the director?
Mm-hmm.
And at this stage, because of the relative strength of the programs, it usually turns out the man is a director, but I think that isn't going to be true much longer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we were going to switch now and discuss the Northern Nigeria project.
That project developed about the time or before I came into the office, but Lynn was very interested in having the school have an international thrust to its program, and of course had looked around for appropriate ways and appropriate kinds of activities, and how this one turned up I don't happen to know, although I guess in retrospect I would say it was one of the better countries to be in, because with the one exception of the civil war in Nigeria in, when was it in the?
I think it began 66 or 67, somewhere in there, 67.
Yeah, the late 60s somewhere. It was and has been one of the most stable countries in Africa and has had a reasonably democratic administration. I don't know what our current impact is if you looked at it, but at least at that time, it turned out to be a country with a lot of, with money, and with the potential for utilizing our services. The one thing that Lynn did in that thing was to, and this was an interesting aspect of Lynn as an administrator, he recognized that the one way to kill that project would be to have everything they did over there tied back so that they had to come back to Madison to get approval. So he worked through the university administration the authority for expenditures to be made over there, and I suppose that it did not extend to equipment of certain types or certain levels of expense, but for 90% or more of what they were doing, they were authorized to expend their money, and then the university reimbursed their account, so that as they sent the bills back, which they had paid, the university then reimbursed the account. Now, that's not the way in which the university functions, and so they had to make special arrangements to do that. Mm-hmm. But it simply, it sounds like a small thing, but it made a lot of difference over there, because Lynn had a very good perception of how things had to be organized in order to run right. The other thing which he did was he organized that project, and that was essentially his organization, for maximum impact on Nigeria. Now, theoretically, everyone does that, but I think the way Lynn did it and setting it up so that we had a few people in a large number of their teacher education institutions, and our people were teaching with them and not simply serving as consultants, but were teaching in fact in those programs and had a person assigned to that. Each of our people had persons assigned to them who was there, I can't remember the language, what we called them, but who was there, who is their counterpart, that's not that unusual in language, but and that person then was the person who was designed to replace our faculty member when they left. Then we recruited widely over the state of Wisconsin for outstanding teachers in the fields of science, mathematics, principally. I suppose we also did it in English and social studies, but I don't happen to recall. But the science and math, and we took people out of good high schools and sent them over there as teachers, which I think again showed good judgment, because we didn't take people that were, we didn't take, for example, university faculty people to go over there and teach in their training schools, because those training schools we were working with were essentially the equivalent of high school training schools. These were the elementary training schools of Nigeria, and so to use high school teachers, I think, was a much, much smarter and much better way to do that. Mm-hmm. So that you had knowledgeable people, and then you had the impact provided for by working out the counterpart system. And we worked with, I don't know how many in all of their schools, I've forgotten, 8 or 10 of their colleges, and over a long enough period of time so that we had some impact on them. Then we also had, as a part of that, a person working in the university at, what's the name of the place, Amadabello, and that was Bob Tabachnik, who was, so we had somebody at the training level so that there could be some relationship between what we were doing out in the training colleges and in the university itself, which was supposed to be working with preparation of materials and a variety of other things that were necessary. So I think it was a well-designed project, which Lynn essentially designed himself, and to the extent that you can change developing countries, and I have some real reservations about that, I think that was as well designed a project as you could get.
Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong, but originally the program was intended to run 2 or 3 years or something of that nature. Isn't that correct?
Well, I think that was simply the first grant. That is, you know, that AID would only fund, and that was a combination, too, as I remember, of AID and Ford.
Right.
Or did it start out as Ford? I think it started out as a combination.
Ford probably initiated it.
They initiated it, and then they stayed in it, so we had a combination of funds. Mm-hmm. And I suspect it was originally designed as, it could have been designed to be a longer project, but the original funding was probably 2 or 3 years.
Administratively, I guess, is it difficult or was it difficult to operate with a granting foundation and with the Agency for International Development and the University? I mean, did that require developing anything new?
Well, I think that if I remember, I don't remember too much detail about that, but because Lynn kept the responsibility for that project himself. But I think that we worked it out neatly, so the things that AID wouldn't do, we could do with Ford, because Ford was more flexible. Mm-hmm. So that it gave us a substantially increased degree of flexibility in the way in which we could get money and how we could use it. Because AID is pretty well tied in terms of the way in which you expend funds and what you can expend them for, whereas Ford would let you spend them for anything they approved, that is, anything that was in the original approval, whereas AID had very tight restrictions on the kinds of things they would support. But I don't remember any specific problems. There may have been a number in the university trying to keep all the accounts clear, but...
Yeah. Okay. I've also heard, maybe you can talk to this, that a problem that developed, at least in the early years, or developed at some point, was that the persons who were being sent over to teach in the teacher colleges had too much of their time taken up teaching, per se, as actually
taking
over.
Yeah, that is true.
Did that happen?
Yes, I had forgotten that. But I think that when they went, Lynn was concerned that they had no time to develop materials, because one of the problems over there was they didn't have materials. And so our people had to be responsible for developing the learning materials that students were going to use. And we also wanted them to have some time to talk to their counterpart people. And originally the Nigerian government simply wanted the service. This was not unusual, and it isn't unusual today, I don't think, mm-hmm. for the government to say what we really want are teachers. And I think Lynn had to work his way out of that so that we finally got some kind of an adjustment in terms of load. But the original proposal between AID and Nigeria was essentially for us to provide teachers mm-hmm. who were working full-time like anybody else was working over there.
It's also true that as part of this program...
In other words, Nigeria didn't see our role, in a sense, as... really helping them change their teacher education program.
You're,
they were looking for competent.
For
right.
Well, from what I understand of talking to friends who taught in Nigeria, Nigerians,
yeah.
they did the same thing within their own country, with
yes.
Northern Nigeria.
Yeah.
Also part of the program, you recruited and brought Nigerians to the university for training. How did that work out? Was that part of the original project?
I don't remember that.
Uh-huh.
I don't know anything about that, but other than that, yeah, I have some vague recollection that it occurred. I would have guessed that, again, that was in science and math, and that probably Milt Pella and was heavily involved in that, and could, I don't know whether Mayer, when John Mayer was still with us then or not. I don't think he was, mm-hmm. but I don't really remember that. Lynn could probably tell you that.
I guess the last thing that we have to cover generally is the first years of the Department of Curriculum Instruction and its operation. One thing that I came across in looking at materials was that early on the department had trouble knowing what it was. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Well. Only, I think, in this sense that the problem they were confronted with psychologically was that groups of faculty were organizing themselves and leaving, and the groups that were left were essentially were made up of for the largest part of what had been the old methods department of. When there was a separate methods department at Wisconsin High School. You know, these were the people like Russ Hostler in business and Mel Pella in science, and so you had all the secondary methods people plus the elementary education, essentially methods people. And I think that psychologically A number of them simply felt that they were becoming, as I think I said the other day, the department of everything else, whatever was left.
Mm-hmm.
So a number of us used to say, well, you know, don't take that view. Take the view that the department, that what is left is in fact curriculum and instruction, and that had you had your druthers, you might yourself have pulled this off separately.
Mm-hmm.
I think the reason they didn't is that the groups that left separately were groups that were much more tightly related to each other, like the educational psychologists or the counseling people or the admin people. They were heavily oriented either to, well, principally to the development of research and graduate programming, and CNI did not have that. CNI always had the heavy orientation to the pre-service preparation of teachers. And they felt that they had great losses by having the learning people leave and having the development people leave and having the history and philosophy people leave. And they felt that this was all should remain a part of the teacher preparation program. So I think there were some losses as a result of the other groups pulling out. And I think mention the other day that part of the way that finally was resolved was by the creation of a program committee which in fact controls the program. The problem there being that the undergraduate teacher preparation program is not the responsibility of any single department.
Mm-hmm.
So it's difficult to affect it. And the people who, the group that had the largest number of persons who were interested in that program was curriculum and instruction. There were people in Ed Psych interested, but only a few. There were people in Ed Policies interested, but only a few. There are people in Ed Admin interested, but only a few.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in CNI, that was the bulk of the group, and so they felt they were the principal department involved in teacher preparation, and yet they didn't control the program, and the other aspects they had were under the control of other departments. So any organizational structure has its strengths and weaknesses, and I think the strength of the organization that was adopted was that it develop strong research and graduate teaching departments for all areas, even including CNI, which became a stronger graduate teaching and research department. The weakness or the disadvantage to the new structure was it became much more difficult to offer a cohesive teacher education program because you had to cross three or four departments to get things done.
Mm-hmm.
And that is difficult.
A few years after the department was started, I think 1968, a number of specific things came up in the notes I looked at. One of them, I think maybe you already been talking to it, there was quite a discussion over the organizational integration of the school, trying to fit everything together. Perhaps that is what you've already been talking to. Another thing that came up was seemed to be quite a debate over the acquisition of a dial access system, which was apparently to be a present from a company, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that? What was going on there? That is, in the past, the school has had grants from and money from various companies for research, you know, Parker Penn Company and so on. Why was the dial access cause such a stir?
I don't remember that explicitly, but I do remember that that company was going to give us this dial access system. I think that the stir may have arisen out of maybe two counts. One, Lynn was trying to get the School of Education faculty to become modern and updated in their use of new technologies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the reason for. And Stiles had also been interested in this. That was the reason for starting the multimedia laboratory, which had originally been in the big lecture room in the old education building, and that essentially had been a gift as well that Stiles had negotiated, and they'd been trying to get faculty to use that. Then, as I recall, the dial access system came out of the instructional research lab, and again they were trying to get a system so that you could centrally have these materials available, and then a faculty member could arrange to get them into their particular classroom
mm-hmm.
for uses. So I think the I don't really recall what it was. I would guess the problem arose because if we were going to spend any money on it, many of the faculty would have felt that there were other things they'd rather see it spent on because they weren't planning to use it. And there was also some resistance to the Instructional Research Lab and to Phil Lambert as a professional. And a lot of faculty didn't really like to work with that lab.
Mm-hmm. There was another thing that came out of CNI specifically that year, and that there seemed to be the complaint that the dean's office, under Dean McCarty's office, the framework of it was sort of jumbled up, I guess is the way they would put it. Do you remember what was that involving? Was that over a specific issue, or is it sort of a general complaint, or they were just because it was a new dean?
I don't happen to recall that. They, I think I would guess probably that McCarty was not an experienced administrator when he came in,
mm-hmm.
and at any level. He had been a school administrator in a little bitty town in someplace in Nebraska or North Dakota or South Dakota or someplace, and had gone on to be a professor, and I think is a very competent researcher professor. And I think he had some difficulties in adjusting to the organizational problems of a school of education, which had many diverse interests and elements and had a very powerful faculty tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be my guess as I observed.
The, there are a few other things that came up in the last, in 1969 through about 71. One of the primary issues that came up involved student participation within the department,
mm-hmm.
participation in the operation of the department,
mm-hmm.
Went on for several years.
Yeah.
Can you discuss that a little bit in terms of what was going on there?
Well, this was a part of the student movement, of course, of the late 60s, in which students were trying to get more control of their education and of their lives in the university. And there were a lot of moves inside the School of Education or in the Department of Curriculum and Instruction to accommodate this interest.
Mm-hmm.
One of the principal leaders of that accommodation was Fred Newman. And there, I don't remember some of the other actors involved in it, but my own feeling on what happened and the basic argument, there were a substantial number of faculty, perhaps, who felt that students shouldn't have any greater involvement at all, that the faculty knew what was best for the student in terms of curriculum and evaluation, at least in the academic area. I'm not discussing now the general student affairs area or student life area. And then there were people like Fred Newman who felt that the students should have a voice in all the matters that occurred in the department. So I guess my feeling, I view myself as having taken an intermediate position, and that is the learner needs to be consulted by the faculty member in order to help the learner make a better judgment about what the learner's needs are, and in order to help interpret those needs for instruction. But I also believe strongly that the student cannot design their curriculum. In fact, I have a saw that I've used to cover that, which says if you can fully design the curriculum, you need not experience it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that. I think it's the student cannot describe what it is they need to learn. They can describe the problems that they have. They can describe what they would regard as their, if they have an experience, for instance, in teaching, they can describe what it is causing them difficulty, and they may have some they'll have a varying degree of knowledge about what possible solutions there are. So I think that was the basic argument that went on in the department, and I took a vigorous position against having students determine the curriculum. I also took a vigorous position against students participating in decision-making in the department, but I favored students participating in information-giving in the department and seeking students' views on curriculum and seeking students' views on faculty evaluation. In fact, during that same period, from about 67 to 70, I was in the divisional executive committee of social studies and was chairman of that for 2 years, from 68 to 70. And that was the first division which required departments to submit, along with their recommendations for tenure, the results of student evaluations of teaching. So I felt then and still feel that student evaluations, for example, are very important, but I do not think that they are the decision-making element. I do not think students should decide whether faculty members are competent or incompetent or whether they should or should not get tenure. But I think that that input is absolutely essential. So that's essentially the position that I took, and that I think it reflected itself in a variety. Remember, we had long arguments, for example, about whether students should have a right to speak at department meetings. And again, I took the position on that. Students are not members of the department. The customary practice in any body then is that for non-members to speak, it requires the consent of the body. So either you make them members of the department, which I was unwilling to do, or you simply say they have a right to request to be heard, and we have an obligation to hear them. But they don't have a, they shouldn't have a right written in rule that any time they wish to speak, they must be heard, because that makes it a different body. Well, that was that went on for at length.
Another problem in those same years that seemed to take up a bit of time was the matter of the nature of the graduate program. One thing that came up was the matter of foreign language requirement for doctoral students. Mm-hmm. That was dropped, but it didn't go willingly, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Well, that was part of a movement in which you were looking at requirements to see whether there was a rationale for the requirement or whether you were simply had a requirement because you had a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there were many of us who felt that the history of the foreign language requirement in the PhD in the United States grew out of a context in which at one period in the history, certainly before World War I, and perhaps in the early period following World War I, a person who wanted to be a researcher scholar would not be competent in his field if he could not read and understand German and French.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the discoveries in science were occurring in Germany, and the humanities were essentially European in their development at that time. And so the language requirement had been a perfectly natural, functional requirement, but had, for many areas, become non-functional. And so I think those of us who favored modifying that requirement to make it optional rather than required, and optional based on the student's field and whether in fact there was a necessity for it, took that position that if it was appropriate to the degree, the student ought to have it. If it was not appropriate to the degree, the student did not have to have it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that required, as I recall, a graduate school change as well. And because the department could not change that without having the graduate school. So the real fight was on whether the graduate school would be willing to let the department specify.
Mm-hmm.
And that as I recall, there were a number of other departments for whom that same thing was applying. It was no longer as critical in science anymore in the 60s for persons to be able to read some other language, as well as the fact that we had a lot better translation facilities and we had a lot better communication of science results or of research results internationally, mm-hmm. both through translation and otherwise. So that was the basic argument, I think, that went on. That essentially killed it in education because there really wasn't any. The research in psychology was no longer taking place in Germany and France. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that affected graduate students, which you may remember, is that in the early 70s there was a difficulty concerning what grade point to require of graduate students for their continued good standing in the department. And I think up to that point, CNI had said the graduate school's three-point standard had been sufficient, but some faculty wanted to change the accepted standard to a 3.25 criteria. And if I remember correctly, the vote on that was extremely close within the department. Why would anyone want to raise that grade point for satisfactory standing? What was the motivation behind that?
I don't really recall that dispute for some reason, mm-hmm. but I would say that I would guess that the reasons why they were doing it were probably twofold. One is there were lots and lots of graduate students, and there probably was a feeling on the part of some that we could do with fewer graduate students. One way to do it was to be more selective. And the other thing is that it's also a fact that if you institute selective procedures, you also increase your demand. It almost always occurs. Mm-hmm. So that as soon as you begin to become more selective, you begin to find increases in demand for people wanting to enter. It's just...
They seem rather contradictory.
Yeah, but it always happens that way. We got an interesting operational system right now. The Oshkosh has been criticized for having no standards, so they've increased their standards for admission to essentially requiring upper half for the automatic admission. And their applications are going up this year like mad, whereas a lot of other institutions are dropping. So it's just one of those things.
Uh-huh.
But I don't recall that specific argument.
Okay. The I guess last thing that I'd like to have you talk to concerning the department was that in 1972, a faculty member, junior faculty member, said that he felt that the executive committee was dominating the operation of the department as a whole and not giving enough word to the rest of the faculty.
Yeah. My perception of that would be that that was a perfectly normal perception of a person who has not yet been chosen as a permanent member of the department, and it's understandable, and both its reason and the cause for it are understandable.
Mm-hmm.
The department...
Put the mic over.
The thing that happens there is that technically the department's actions are supposed to be taken by all the members of the department, and all the members of the department in those days consisted of assistant professors as well as tenured. But because budget matters and personnel matters were handled by the executive committee, a lot of times things got decided in the executive committee, which consisted of the tenured members of the department, which either didn't get referred back properly to the whole department, or there were enough there so that in fact what you had was the same action would have taken place, but if you did it in the department, a non-tenured faculty member would have heard it and had an opportunity to speak. So it was partly perhaps carelessness and inappropriate actions in a sense on the part of the executive committee. But there were individuals, and there still are, who really don't like that system and who think that non-tenured members of the department should participate in making the personnel and budget decisions. And all I can say about that is that that hasn't been the tradition in Madison. It has in some of the other institutions of the system where they haven't differentiated between tenured and non-tenured members because they never really operated a peer system. That is, they didn't use peer judgments. The decisions about individuals making tenure were essentially administrative decisions. So I think that was the argument. And it was, I think, a normal development of those times when people without voices were making arguments that they had a right to have a voice. And I would assume, if I remember that debate, that we made some accommodation. But for example, another thing that happened that non-tenured people didn't appreciate was that a non-tenured person was elected as a member of the personnel committee, which is was the six-person committee that made the recommendations to the executive committee. But that non-tenured person did not participate in judgments about people of his own rank. Hmm. The executive committee also extended that to the next level. Associate professors don't make judgments about people of their own rank either. Now that was a tradition of that department, which had a lot of traditions of that sort. That's not universally followed by Madison departments, but is, that I would say, the general practice to exclude persons from making decisions about persons of one's own immediate peers, one's own assistant professor peers, or one's own associate professor peers. Mm-hmm. So I think no accommodation was made there, except I don't know when the assistant professor was added to the personnel committee. I can't remember that, whether it was operative then or whether it was earlier. It could have been developed then. It could be that when we rewrote the rules of CNI, which would have been done after the divisions of the other units, that what had become acceptable became required. That is, we used to permit, I think, one member to be non-tenured, and I think when the rules were rewritten, we required that one member be non-tenured. Mm-hmm. So that was an accommodation, as I recall, which was made for that purpose.
Thank you.
This, as I recall, occurred when I went back to teaching from the dean's office, and I knew that I was a nominee for the chairmanship and was one of those going to be considered, but nobody talked to me about it. And so I didn't do anything about it. It was mm-hmm. convention so that one never did anything about that in that department. If you were nominated, normally you served your stint, and because we fairly rigidly restricted the tenure in that position to about 3 years. Mm-hmm. Occasionally somebody would come in for four, and occasionally there'd be a lapse and then come back, like Russ Hosner served on more than one occasion. But when we went to the department meeting and it turned out that I got the majority of ballots for the nomination, I was stunned because no one had asked me whether I would be willing to serve at all, and I couldn't understand how that would happen. Uh-huh. But because precedent had been so strong that it was clear that if anybody was going to nominate me and there was going to be some kind of discussion among the other members of the department, somebody would have talked to me to say, how do you feel about it, and, you know, are you willing to do this, because no one has to, you don't have to do it. Uh-huh. As I got to thinking about it later, I decided that what had happened was that what I regarded as a department tradition of long standing was not known because, and I've forgotten the statistic now, but something like two-thirds of the people that were then members of that department had not been in the department more than 6 years. Mm-hmm. Something like that. In other words, there wasn't any tradition in that department which was known by the individuals in the department, because the members of the department had changed so radically. Uh-huh. And it had increased so enormously in such a short period of time that the traditions were not known. So that precipitated that when I went back to try to figure out why that would have happened, and that's what I discovered.
Do you think generally that that sudden influx has had an impact on what have long been Wisconsin traditions of operation?
Yeah, I think it did, and as a matter of fact, it caused a lot of problems in the early 70s and in the late 60s because what I would call the socialization of the new faculty in university practices didn't take place because there were more new faculty than old faculty, and they were coming so fast, and very little of what we had as operating practice was written. It was tradition. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. and precedent in the way in which we function. We function by sort of unwritten agreement developed over a period of time, and I think that caused a lot of difficulty inside the university and misunderstandings on the part of younger faculty who came in, and simply, it of course also produced, I think, some fairly substantial differences in the way in which departments function. Probably not all to the bad. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's just as well not to socialize them. You get some new ideas if you don't. Mm-hmm. If everyone comes in, if you don't come in so slowly they can all be socialized, you will turn up a new idea once in a while. Right. So I think it caused some problems.